From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a 12-year-old boy in Michigan. Tony Moran was an active kid who went to school and hung out with his friends. His parents described him as a jokester. He seemed to always be out and about and having fun. That all changed when his friend was killed in a car accident. Tony was devastated and dealt with the grief and pain for years. Right after the accident, he started experiencing chronic pain in his right leg. It seemed to come from nowhere. The pain became so unmanageable that Tony ended up in the hospital several times, took numerous pain medications, and had to switch to remote schooling. He didn't know where to turn. He didn't understand why no one could diagnose the source of his extreme pain. Then he signed up for a 4-week class that explored the relationship between the mind and the body for people struggling with chronic pain. It was led by Dr. Howard Schubiner, who used a method called Emotional Awareness and Expression Therapy, or EAET. For Tony, the method worked. He unpacked the sources of his pain and worked to manage it. Now, it does not work for everyone. It's not easy. Some pain is purely structural. But Dr. Schubiner says it can work for many people. It was recently recognized as a pain management best practice by the NIH's Task Force to Combat the Opioid Epidemic. This hour, we're talking with him. We're talking with local experts about this approach to pain management. And for listeners who have had extreme pain, severe pain, chronic pain, if there's someone you love who's been in this category, I promise you what we're not going to do, and that came up in a film that we're going to talk about, we're not just going to say it's all in your head. It's not as simple as that. But there may be so much more behind it that comes from our brain, our trauma, our own emotional anguish. It is a really fascinating and complex subject, and I want to welcome our guest now, Dr. Howard Schubiner, Director of the Mind-Body Medicine Program at Providence Hospital in Southfield, Michigan. Doctor, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Dr. Aaron Olden, physician and owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester. Dr. Olden, welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
And William Watson is associate professor in the Departments of Psychiatry and Neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Watson, welcome.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Dr. Schubiner, we had a chance to see a film that tells the story of not only the person we were talking about in the introduction, but a number of people who are suffering pain, sometimes pain in the hands that's really acute, sometimes ongoing migraine issues, sometimes, as we mentioned, the gentleman at the outset, pain in the legs. There are millions of people who have tried to figure out what is causing this. And I have a friend who's a doctor who told me that, you know, when people see the doctor, they kind of walk in thinking, well, they're going to diagnose this and they're going to tell me exactly, you know, it's either this or it's that. We're going to rule out this. We're going to rule in that. And it can be frustrating to hear, we don't fully know, or we have an idea, but we could be wrong here, or it may not be what you think it is. Take me through how anguishing it can be for some of the patients you've worked with who have just wanted answers.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's excruciating. Because the pain is real. All physical pain is real. But it turns out that all physical pain is actually created by the brain. Even when you touch a hot stove, you have an injury, but it's the brain that turns on pain. And this is a revolutionary way of understanding pain that neuroscientists are now teaching us. And so when people have chronic pain, they assume, and most doctors would assume, that there's some very specific structural problem in the body that is causing that pain, and all we have to do is find it so we can treat it. But for the vast majority of people who have chronic pain, it's not so easy. And as you pointed out, doctors do their due diligence, and they work really hard to find the source of the pain, but frequently they can't. And that is so incredibly frustrating. It leads people on journeys to so many different types of therapies, sometimes for years and years, without finding an answer.
And doctor, I know you are aware of two, I think, maybe parallel reactions to some of this work. One is, as I mentioned right at the top here, and it comes up in the film, this idea people say, well, don't tell me it's all in my head, or don't just tell me to sort of mind over matter this thing. The pain is real. Don't tell me it's all in my head. So I'd like you to address that. And then, frankly, for the critics of this kind of work who have sort of implied that it's quackery of some sort, I know you've heard everything. Can you address those ideas?
Sure. Well, what I tell my patients is that anybody who says it's all in your head is being either dismissive, judgmental, or downright cruel. Because when they say that it's all in your head, they're implying that the pain is fake, that it's imaginary, that it's not real, that you're making it up, that it's your fault, that you want the pain, or that you're crazy somehow. And none of that is true. And so we have to establish that, because if you don't establish that, you don't have trust. And if you don't have trust, you can't get anywhere, because the ideas that we're talking about are based in science, based in neuroscience and how the brain works. But they're new and different, and most people really don't understand them.
Well, and so let me, if I could just choose one story from the film, because it left me not only hopeful, but also with my own questions about how pain sort of manifests. And there are many stories like this, but Maureen is someone who had long-term nerve damage. She was told that she needed neck surgery, but she didn't have it because she was nervous about long-term side effects from that. She had this pain in her hand. She couldn't sleep at night many times. It affected her quality of life. It affected how she felt her days were going. It was hard to enjoy certain things. But we learned that her emotional pain began for her when she was in her 20s, when she wanted to be a writer, and she felt that no one in her life supported her, not her family, not her friends. And that was sort of an unrealized dream that not only wasn't unrealized, but sort of felt like mocked and taken away from her. So there was pain in her life from that was maybe stored up over years. She was also angry with her mom for not giving her grandmother the care that her grandmother needed. So she had these aspects of maybe, I guess we'd call it trauma, anger, unresolved issues, emotional damage. But I guess I'm watching her story, and I see someone who's got this pain in her hands, and doctors think it's the source is her neck, etc. Then you've got other people who have migraines. Then you have other people who have leg pain. I guess I'm trying to figure out, I'm not questioning at all the work that you're doing. I'm trying to figure out, why for Maureen was it her hands? Why for someone else is it migraines? Why for someone else is it leg pain? And why for someone else is it no pain? Because we all have sort of emotional baggage of some sort, if that makes sense.
Right. That's a great question. We don't know exactly why the brain chooses which pain to get when its danger signal, goes off. But we do know from very, very clear scientific research that when you give someone an injury, a physical injury, and you scan their brain using fMRI, you see certain parts light up. And when you give them an emotional injury, the same exact parts of the brains light up. So we know that our brains are constructed, and we can say either God designed them that way or we evolved that way, and we don't know why, but our brains are clearly designed so that physical pain and emotional pain create the same outputs in the brain and can create the same exact real pain. Now, why it happened in Maureen's hand as opposed to somewhere else, maybe it was symbolic. Maybe it was just that she was using her hands a lot and her brain chose that area. But the point is that Maureen did not actually have nerve damage. She had pain, but she did not have nerve damage. And the basis of our work is at the beginning is to make a clear and accurate diagnosis so that we can help understand why people are having the pain and give them the explanation and then the tools to deal with it. But it turned out in her case and with Tony, the one you were talking about at the top, and people with migraine, is these are not actually structural problems. They're not, tumors, they're not infections, they're not fractures. And so when we can see that these are actually neural circuits in the brain, then we can help people to free their mind and deal with whatever emotions might be underlying it so that they can get better.
This is where I think the critics who are maybe looking for something more traditionally scientific or measurable or studyable might say that, okay, well, if what you are asserting is that emotional trauma psychological damage that's accrued over time can manifest in real physical pain, if that's true, it would all be migraine, or it would all be in the hands, or it would all be in one, not sort of scattershot around the body per individual. It seems to me what you are arguing is every person is different, every person's trauma is different, and it manifests in people in different ways, even if that's sort of hard for us to kind of get our heads around at first. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly right. And actually, everyone has a brain, everybody has a body, and everybody has this mind-body connection. And everyone has experienced some form of physical reactions to stress or emotions. If you have a rough day and you get a headache, if you get embarrassed and your face turns red, if you're going to give a speech in front of, 100 people and your stomach starts doing flips, those are mind-body connections. And these are normal. I mean, everybody has this. What I tell my patients is it's not that you're crazy, it's that you're human.
That's actually a really interesting sort of way of connecting it, because some of us sweat profusely when we're really nervous. I remember when I had to give a talk when my book came out, and I ended up doing the entire talk with T-Rex arms because I didn't want people to see how much I was sweating. And my dad said to me afterwards, he says, "Oh, I should have warned you. That's sort of a Dawson thing. When we get really fired up about something we care about, there's nothing you can do to stop that." I said, that's a nice warning that came years too late. But that's an interesting point. I mean, that is a body response that may not be the same for everybody. So let me ask the other panelists here. Dr. Aaron Olden, physician and owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester. These stories that we're talking about, there's not a film to see in Rochester now, but if you're interested in the film that is kind of tells some of these stories, it's called This Might Hurt, and you can find that at thismighthurtfilm.com. It is worth watching. It's really powerful. What do you make of the ideas expressed here about how pain manifests and what we are learning about it?
Yeah, so thanks again.
Come right up to the mic there for me.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. I was really struck by this film, on a personal level, too, because, as you know, we lost about 500,000 Americans over the past two decades from overdoses on opioids. And my brother was one of those people. And I just took a look at my practice and felt like I needed to change some things. I needed to take a look at how I was treating pain patients in a different way. I love the movie that you just described, and I love what Dr. Schubiner said. One of the quotes that he said the movie was, how different would it be if when someone comes to a physician with a new problem for which no structural cause has been found, and the doctor would say, "What's going on in your life?" instead of simply just writing a prescription. So, I'm seeing it in my office. I'll be talking with someone about a particular pain that they might have or a particular experience that they may have had in their life. And, I can see that their hands start to clench up, or they might communicate with me, my stomach is starting to churn. And what I think, we're each advocating is cultivating a certain level of mindfulness in the individual to understand what's going on in my body. Is this a signal of some kind that I need to be paying attention to? As you are sitting here and you're talking to me and you're describing this event that happened a couple of months ago, you're actually experiencing it in your body right now as you talk to me. So would it be okay if we investigate that a little bit? And it's hard work, and it's not for every patient. I think, as you mentioned, we want to make sure that folks have had a very thorough evaluation by a physician and that no particular structural cause has been found. We're kind of talking about more chronic pain. And I imagine you'll probably, talk with Dr. Watson as well, who manages folks who have experienced what's called pseudo seizures, where they have a seizure, they're admitted to the hospital, and there's no evidence on brain EEG that there was any abnormal electrical activity. And after doing this sort of therapy and working with folks, for many people, those episodes go away. So, my approach, which I think, many people may not know, the biopsychosocial approach originated right here in Rochester. And it's a way of looking at a patient's not only just their physical makeup, but also psychological. What's their history? What's their level of stress? And socially, you know, what's their living situation? What kind of relationships do they have? What, you know, are they exercising? So, you know, what we're talking about here is a, you know, kind of a very specific approach to chronic pain that I think in some ways could be extrapolated to many difficult to treat conditions.
And I want to say I'm deeply sorry for your loss. You and so many Americans, so many people around the world have lost people to opioid addiction. The film mentions something that I think is an important takeaway for anybody listening right now, which is even if you are someone who uses opioids and is not addicted, which is still a majority, I mean, the rates of addiction are much higher than we were first promised in the 90s, as we know now. But I know, I understand, we get email from people who say, don't take them away from me. I need them for pain. I'm not addicted. But they're an important part of my life. My own mother has talked to me about stuff like this. I understand. But the film makes a distinction, which is that even for the opioids that work best for people, they're just helping sort of cover up symptoms. They're not getting to a root cause of pain. And I think it's probably valuable for us to keep that in mind. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Yep. I think you're absolutely right. You know, in my experience, you know, several years ago treating patients with pain, I have patients come in and tell me, you know, the medication's not working as well. I need a higher dose. And I found it really important to explore, like, you know, Dr. Schubiner said, what's going on in your life right now? You know, before we just go increasing these medications, you know, what's happening? You know, can we talk a little bit more about your, you know, your mental health, about your emotional wellness, about how you're sleeping? You know, just all these things that we're learning are just so important for our bodies, you know, body's health.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me turn now to Dr. William Watson and get your thoughts, William, if you could, on sort of the general themes here that for many listeners may be totally logical, and for many it may sound really out there, the notion that pain can really be derived in this way, that the pain is not fake, people are really experiencing it, but our understanding of it might need to broaden. How do you see it?
Right. I like what Dr. Schubiner was saying, that the emotions for all of it, we all have emotions. We all have a brain. We all have emotions. And our emotions tend to show up in our bodies inevitably. If we see somebody that's an old friend, our body tends to respond by a smile on our face. It's an automatic smile. It's not something we're doing on purpose. We're not making it up. We're not faking it. It's just this thing that happens. If we're, as Howard was saying, if we get embarrassed, we might turn red. If we get angry, we might feel kind of tense in our arms and shoulders. If we feel sad, we feel a heaviness inside of ourselves and want to kind of just feel the weight of the world on our shoulders. And that's true for all the emotions. And normally we don't pay any attention to those bodily responses because they don't create that much of a problem. But some emotions are very painful to experience. Some emotions are loaded. Some emotions are complicated to let ourselves feel because we not only feel the emotion, but we feel emotions about the emotion. We don't like to get angry. We don't like to get sad. We might not feel, we feel vulnerable if we're sad. We feel scared we're going to hurt somebody or be hurt if we're angry. And then we have not only the feeling, but that anxiety that comes with the feeling. And both of those things will show up in our bodies. The anger will show up in a certain sense of heat and tension in our body. And the anxiety will show up about the anger in terms of clutching, tensing up against it. And that tensing can be quite powerful. And those muscles that involve in tensing up instinctively against those feelings that we don't like can create a lot of pain, dizziness, lightheadedness, stomach aches, nausea, even passing out and convulsing when that anxiety really floods in. These are variants of normal human processes. They have to do with things that we've all been through, feelings that we all have, and feelings about those feelings. So a lot of what Dr. Schubiner is doing is helping people begin to pay attention to these things that we normally are primed to ignore, things in ourselves that we don't like or that feel threatening to experience. And when we ignore those things, then they tend to show up in our bodies instead of being experienced in our emotions. That allow us, if it's experienced in our emotions, it allows us to think about it, know it, process it, and deal with it.
Dr. Watson, is anger potentially the most consistently toxic to us? I mean, I ask because there's a powerful question that comes up in this film and elsewhere. If you ask anybody, who are you angry at? Everybody listening right now can probably answer that question. And I don't mean today or for some sort of small slight. I mean, Do you have ongoing anger? Do you have resentment? Do you have contempt that you hold deep in reserve and sort of that burns in you? Is it likely that anger is near the top of the list for us if we are potentially our own source of some of this pain?
I do think that anger is one of the most complicated emotions we can have because it tends to, at root, threaten our sense of security with those that we're close to. If we're angry with somebody that we care about, it creates a dilemma for us. I could tell them, but they might get angry back. They might attack me, or they might feel so hurt. They feel devastated. They may not like me anymore. And it can feel like it's going to threaten our sense of belonging, connection, and security. And that's what makes anger in particular so problematic or complicated. It's not that it can't be worked with. It's just that it's complicated. It can be complicated. And for those reasons, that's one of the feelings that we tend to want to block out or get rid of, overlook or ignore or deny. Even if we don't have ongoing seething resentment, something pisses us off, makes us mad, it can be complicated to know what to do with it, even if we don't have any historical trauma or burning resentments. It's just like, I like to be nice. I like to help people. I don't want people being mad at me. So I'll take the hit. I'll deal with it. I won't bring it up. I'll be fine. I want to make sure they're fine, so I'll just be quiet. Mm. A natural human response.
Mm. Before I grab our first phone call, Keith, hang there for a second. And listeners, if you want to talk about chronic pain and some of what we're learning and kind of working through this hour, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. 263-WX6I if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. Dr. Schubner, can you weigh in on the connection of anger to chronic pain?
Yeah, for certain. Bill, Dr. Watson described it, I think, really well. What happens is that anger is a normal and healthy response. You know, if you're angry, it's usually for a reason, and it's there to protect us. We need anger if someone's attacking us. But what happens in the chronic situation, if we're angry about something and we keep playing it over and over in our mind, and then we're just holding that anger in, and we have nowhere to express it, no way to express it, then that anger is just sitting there. And it's bothering us, and it's bothering us, and it's weighing on us. And then we start to feel guilty about being angry. And then we have what Bill would describe as a complex emotion. And then, at some point, your danger signal is going to go off, and it's going to alert you. And our brain can't talk to us and say, by the way, you really need to express your emotions. You really need to deal with that neighbor who's driving you nuts. Or you really need to deal with your mom or your son or whatever. Instead, it sends us a message, and the message may be in the form of a headache, a neck ache, a stomach ache. It might be in the form of depression, anxiety, fatigue, insomnia. I mean, how many people have spent sleepless nights because they're worried about something, mm-hmm. right? This is just part of how we are.
Before I take audience response, and we already have some here, I just want to give you space one more time, Dr. Schubner, to kind of describe not only a little bit more about what EAET is, emotional awareness and expression therapy, but realistically, if someone goes down that path, what have you seen in terms of the likelihood that they're going to find some kind of relief?
Well, let me just describe a simple kind of a model of how we work with people, and then I'll tell you some of the results of our recent research studies. First step is to make a clear and accurate diagnosis. As Dr. Olden said earlier, make sure there's not a structural problem. Make sure we're not missing something that's serious, a tumor, a fracture, an infection, et cetera. The second step is to educate people about this brain-body connection and make sure they can understand that we're not saying it's all in their head. The third step is to reduce fear of the symptoms. And so we found that there's a very powerful connection between worry about the pain itself, which creates more pain. It's a vicious cycle. Pain leads to more fear of the pain, focus on the pain, frustration with the pain, and that actually leads to more pain. So most people with chronic pain actually get worse over time, and the pain often spreads over time. And that process alone, which we're calling pain reprocessing therapy, is enough to lower pain or eliminate pain in a majority of people. And we just did a back pain study, which was written up in the Washington Post this past Sunday, and we can send you copies, and your listeners can have copies of the research article that we published, showing that of the people we treated with chronic back pain using this pain reprocessing therapy, just lowering fear, educating them, et cetera, we found that 75% of them were pain-free in 1 month. So that's an amazing process. And then on top of that, we have the EAET method, which is emotional awareness and expression therapy. And we've also shown in randomized controlled research studies that this is more effective than the standard kinds of talk therapies that people are used to. And so when you combine these techniques of the diagnosis, the education, the pain reprocessing, and the EAET, you can have really powerful effects on actually reducing or eliminating pain instead of what people go to as pain management, where the idea is just let's manage your pain and help you cope with it. That's not what people want.
Talking to Dr. Howard Schubner, who is director of Mind-Body Medicine Program at Providence Hospital in Southfield, Michigan, and has been, I think, realistically a pioneer in helping people understand chronic pain in a different way. Dr. Aaron Olden, physician and owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester, Dr. William Watson, Bill's an associate professor in the departments of psychiatry and neurology at URMC. Let's take some of your feedback. This is Keith in Fairport. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Evan, I got a couple questions. One to the panel is, why is all stimulus to your teeth interpreted as pain, whether it be heat, cold, decay, or whatever, but all stimulus to your teeth is interpreted as pain. Secondly, to your first guest, Dr. Schubner, he was discussing as to where pain may have came from. He mentioned evolution, but he also mentioned design. And I'd like to ask him, does he think we as humans were designed?
Designed.
Meaning if we were designed, then there has to be a designer.
Oh, okay.
And somebody designed us.
Dr. Schubner, go ahead.
Thank you so much, Keith. I appreciate it. What I was saying when I talked to my patient, the brain is the way it is. We don't know why it's the way it is, but it's the way it is. Some people believe in intelligent design, that God created us this way. Some people believe that evolution created us this way. I was just leaving room open for whatever people's beliefs are. My personal beliefs are that we evolved this way. Your question about teeth is really interesting. Again, part of the way we are is we have all these neural circuits in our brain and the nerve connections. So when you injure a tooth, the nerves are sending danger signals to the brain, and our brain then will usually turn on pain when you injure a tooth. But sometimes, you know, you give cold stimulus to a tooth or hot stimulus to a tooth, the same nerves are generating those danger signals. The interesting thing about pain is that not all injuries cause pain, and this has been well documented in the research literature for many years. It turns out, and this is the weirdest thing to say, and people freak out, like, wait, what are you saying, Dr. Schubner? But pain is an opinion that the brain makes. Pain is a judgment or a determination that the brain makes. Usually when you touch a hot stove, you will experience pain. But I've seen situations, and it's written up, where situations where people, I'm sure you've seen this, where people sustain an injury and they don't actually get pain. Their brain may not turn on pain. And this is a subconscious response.
Does that answer the question, Keith?
Pretty much so. Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate that. Anything, Dr. Olden, you want to add? He zeroed in on teeth. You know, anything we feel in the teeth is pain.
Well, I wonder if I could ask Dr. Schumer to comment about... a similar story that was written up about a gentleman who was working out in the field, a construction worker, and sustained an injury where a nail actually went right through his shoe. And he developed extreme pain, was sent to the hospital, And they managed to somehow get this nail out of the shoe, and they found out that it went right through his second and third toes. So there was actually no injury whatsoever. But this gentleman was experiencing severe pain. And so I think it just, again, it just sort of points out how powerful our brains are in terms of generation of pain.
Dr. Schubner, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, it's exactly right. This is a true story. It's written up in the British Medical Journal that the lack of injury, that pain can exist in the absence of injury. And we know the converse can happen. People can have an injury and not have pain. And this, again, points to the power that the brain has to turn on pain or turn off pain. And what we're doing is we're harnessing the power of our brains, understanding how our brains work and how that relates to this condition of experiencing pain, so that we can help people eliminate pain as opposed to managing it, particularly when there's no injury. And we just completed a study where we took 220 people with chronic neck and back pain, and we evaluated them very carefully to determine, is there really a structural injury or not? And most people would think, and most doctors would think, if there's back pain or neck pain, especially chronically, there's got to be a structural injury. But it turned out in our study, 85% of people with chronic neck and back pain did not have a structural injury to account for their pain. In other words, their pain was derived by their brain. And it's a shocking thing to say. We're going to publish that paper. But it's really not that uncommon. If you take people with headaches, chronic headaches, and you do MRIs of their brain and CAT scans of their brain, and you examine their teeth and their sinuses and their ears, you will find that the vast majority of people do not have a structural disease causing that pain. The same is true with people with fibromyalgia, people with irritable bowel syndrome, and most people with chronic pelvic pain syndromes. So it's extremely common for chronic pain to exist in the absence of a structural injury. And these are revolutionary statements. I mean, these are statements that may sound wild and crazy, but we have the research to back them up.
And Dr. Watson, if I could shift over to you and just ask for, I think, a distinction here, because I already have email from listeners who are saying, oh, well, this is just mind over matter. I think there's a couple of things that stand out in terms of pain. There's chronic pain, and then there's how do we deal with structural pain, whether it's from an injury or sometimes medical procedure. So some of what Dr. Schubner is describing is the way our brains work and the way that in the absence of structural pain, we can still feel chronic pain. And that, assuming that's right, is a revolutionary idea that can help many, many people. On the other hand, what we know is that everybody sort of will describe their own pain tolerance differently. I tend to think, generally speaking, women tolerate it better than men. Not always true, of course, but certainly in my life, I don't do very well with it. I also know there are people who are fearful of medical procedures but need those procedures and will tell their doctor, you know, I'm too scared of the pain. I'm scared of what this entails for me. And that can be very, very difficult, especially if there's cancer involved or other treatments. And I guess what I'm wondering, Dr. Watson, is can we get to a point, is this related to the notion of just chronic pain, or can we also train ourselves to say, hey, I've got a medical procedure coming up. It's going to be, the half hour prep's going to be tough, but I can train myself to handle that pain better, if that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. Well, there are certainly, you know, when you take pain, some sort of bodily experience of a needle into your arm it's the anticipation often that exacerbates that pain. So, you know, you get the combination of the physical injury, whether that's getting a shot or, you know, twisting your ankle or having a bad back because you have strained it when you lifted that weight that you shouldn't have done by yourself. That you have a legitimate injury that is actually causing pain. That if you add on top of that feelings about it, anxiety about it, that magnifies your experience of pain. So you always have the combination of what's going on physically plus our kind of emotional response to it, and that's true actually not just of of bodily injury, but that's true of much of life. We have a difficult interaction with a boss, and it's our feelings about that interaction that have to do with how we wind up walking away feeling about it all.
Yeah, I mean, I wish listeners could bottle up what producer Megan Mack has been able to do. We talked about Megan's breast cancer earlier this week, and I have never met anybody who just goes head on into whatever needs to be done and deals with it and is just remarkable about pain management. I mean, just dealing with pain and just not making sort of a big deal about it. I'm not denigrating at all people who do. I'm one of them. Like, I'm somebody who needs to do much better. But just the mentality that Megan takes into this stuff is absolutely inspiring. No, you know, unnecessary anxiety, no overly amped fear. And then the result is, yeah, okay, a procedure might have quote-unquote hurt, but it's over, and it wasn't exacerbated by sort of a mental approach that made it worse. And so I have learned a lot just watching that. And I know our listeners are learning a lot, so let me keep getting back to their feedback here.
Well, if I may, I'd also like to add a coda to that,
yeah.
To that point you're making, which is that one of the difficulties we can run into with ourselves is trying to be like Megan. And we can try and tell ourselves, I shouldn't be having this reaction. I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to power through. And that can work in the short term, and that can work fine for some of us, and some of us are constituted that way, that that's just the way we roll. But for others of us, when we try to do that, we wind up just sort of brushing aside things that our mind is trying to tell us need to be attended to. So sometimes it's more useful to notice what's making us nervous and try to find ways to lower that anxiety sort of authentically, rather than just ignore it. And that might be talking it over with our physician. That might be getting supportive friends or family. That might be developing sort of exercises that we engage in to sort of calm ourselves and bring ourselves into a state of equilibrium. And then we can move forward. But it's important not to just sort of gut it out, because lots of us are tuned up to dismiss internal signs of distress, because that's how we get through life and that's how we get success. And that, again, is good in the short, can work in the short term, but as a long-term principle, if that's all we ever do with internal signs of distress or tension or being bothered by something, if we always just brush it aside and ignore it, that's a recipe for developing increasing tension in our bodies and burnout.
Mika and Webster on the phone. I'm coming to you next, but let me just read Andrew's email, because it's sort of a similar thread to what we heard Dr. Olden mention, which is, you know, maybe changing your approach and talking more about, you know, what's going on in your life. Andrew says, not everyone wants a therapy session when they go to their doctor, you know, and that's an interesting comment. But Dr. Olden, let me start with you. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly true. I think what we're trying to do is meet every person where they're at. I mean, we know certain things about the human body are the same from one person to the next, you know, our structures, our bones and everything, but our experiences are very different. And, you know, I think the challenge here is, first of all, we're working within a system that is asking primary care doctors to see, you know, 20, 30 patients a day, 10 or 15 minutes, you know, a session. And so we're under this tremendous amount of pressure to see patients. And the system doesn't really set us up for the most of compassionate encounters. And, you know, these are some of the most compassionate physicians that I've experienced in the last, you know, 15 years of working. And I think what we're suggesting, if you take some of the, if you just suspend maybe your disbelief or, you know, don't worry so much about what the approach is called, what we're advocating is meeting patients where they're at and empowering patients. So instead of just saying, I can't tell you how many times I've heard someone coming to me saying, you know, I was told I had scoliosis at age, you know, 15 and I'm never going to do this. Or I've told I've had this diagnosis and I'm never going to be able to do that. I think what we're trying to say is I want to teach you about your body. I want to empower you to get better. I'm going to ask you to participate in your care a little bit. And, you know, that's kind of a challenge. To go back to the system again, we've been taught that if I have blood pressure, I go to the doctor and I get a pill. If I have pain, I go to the physician and I get, you know, a pain medication. And you know, this is a little bit more of a participatory type of care. Let me teach you about your body. Actually, teach me about your body. Mm-hmm. Help me to understand what you're feeling, because I really care and I really want you to get better.
Dr. Schudner, what do you think? What would you say to Andrew?
Yeah, certainly. You know, you go to the doctor, you just want an answer. You have an earache, the doctor finds an ear infection, great, take the antibiotics. That's how we roll. That's what we want. But what we're talking about here is when there's no simple solution, when the solution is a little more complicated, and when people have not found answers by going to regular doctors. The people that I'm seeing are people who've been to 2 doctors, 5 doctors, 10 doctors, 20 doctors without an answer, without a solution. They're desperate. They're hopeless. And they want to do anything to get better. And they, therefore, if they're open to these ideas, they're willing to participate. They want to learn how they can help themselves, because I'm not the one curing people. I'm giving people the tools to recover. And it's a different model, but it's necessary for some of these complex chronic situations, as opposed to the simple situation where you need an appendix out or you need your ear infection treated.
Dr. Watson, you want to add to that?
Summed it up very nicely. I would agree.
Let me get back to your phone calls. Mika in Webster. Next time, Mika, go ahead.
Hi there. I'm very grateful to your panelists for this conversation. I just wanted to share a quick experience. I experienced overnight relief from like a 9 or 10 in terms of back pain to about a 3. It sounds crazy, but by reading the book Healing Back Pain by Dr. John Sarno. And I was just wondering, you know, if your guests might be able to speak to the legacy that he left. He has some people that have worked with him, for example, Nicole Sachs, who runs the website The Cure for Chronic Pain. She has a method called Journal Speak, and I've used that to kind of journal about things that have, it's helped me to keep the pain away, and that's been great. But really overnight experiencing a radical shift in my pain just by the education that I received in that book. And then also kind of speaking to maybe perhaps how we can continue to retrain an overactivated nervous system through other mind-body practices. Would just love to hear if they subscribe to Dr. John Sarno, if they believe that their work is within that same legacy or is a different path, I'd be grateful.
Oh, no, so Dr. Schubner, this is right up his alley. Dr. Schubner, go ahead.
Thanks so much, Mika. I really appreciate your comments. I have a picture of Dr. Sarno on my wall. I got started on this path back in 2002 by reading a book by Dr. Sarno, The Mind-Body Prescription. And I was so moved by it that I called him up and I said, Dr. Sarno, can I come work with you for a while? And he said, yes, Howard, come to New York City. And I went there and worked with him for a few days, and we got along well. And I came back to Michigan, and I decided to set up a program using his methods. And over the years, we've evolved. That method has evolved and changed and grown. And me and other people have added to it. And so he's one of my heroes, and we are using his methods. And the reason you got so much better is you turned off the danger signal in your brain by realizing that you're not as physically damaged as you thought you were. And that is a powerful thing. And that's why the people in our research study, 75% of them became pain-free in 1 month with chronic back pain. And so, yeah, Dr. Sarno started this whole thing. He was a pioneer. He died at age 95 a few years ago.
Also in Webster, let me get John on the phone. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Evan. I'm in my 80s. During the Second World War, I had rickets. It affected my spine. I was in chronic pain. It wasn't until I came to the United States that I was put on Vicodin. For quite a while, I never got addicted to it. I had 9 back surgeries, 3 of which were fusions. I have 3 sets of Herringer rods in my back. But the turnaround was when I had a Boston Scientific spinal cord stimulator put in. And I tell you, I'm the poster child for that. Just practically no pain at all because of that spinal cord stimulator. I had a second one put in after the battery in the first one was wearing out. It's now a St. Jude model that I have in there. Same effect. Absolutely tremendous. No pain.
John, the surgeries, the many surgeries you had, did they help you?
No. My spine was affected quite badly, and I had the fusions and the Harrington rods put in, but within 2 years, I was back again. And that's what happened over a great number of years. And I never was out of pain until I had, when the doctor put in a spinal cord stimulator, and it was just light versus dark for me. Mm.
Well, John, I'm glad to hear you're doing well, and it's always nice to hear from you. Thank you for the call. There's a couple things come to mind. I'd like to ask all three of our guests to weigh in on this. Dr. Schubner, in the film that we watched, the question of back and neck surgeries came up, and I will say that I have friends who are from Europe but are practicing medicine in the United States. They're surprised at how often back surgery is suggested by the medical community. I'm not saying it hasn't helped some people. It certainly has. But I wonder if, generally speaking, you feel that we are over-prescribing surgery, back and neck surgery, at the expense of maybe some other treatments or ideas. I mean, John eventually found success with this spinal cord stimulator, but I wonder, sort of writ large, what you think about back and neck pain and how we approach it.
Yeah, thanks for asking. First of all, there's several books on this. There's a great book by Richard Deyo, D-E-Y-O, about the back pain industry. There's a great book by Catherine Raymond called Crooked about the back pain industry, and they describe this very well. They've looked at all the research. I've looked at all the research. We are spending $20 billion per year in the U.S. on back surgeries. We do more back surgeries than anywhere else. And most of those back surgeries are not for neurologic damage. Back surgery can be necessary for neurologic damage, but most of those back surgeries in the U.S. are being done for chronic pain. And so if you take our point of view that 85% of people with chronic pain don't have a structural injury, that kind of raises some eyebrows. And if you look at the research on fusion back surgery, the kind of fusions that John had, the research shows that there has never been a study in a randomized controlled fashion which has shown that back surgery is better than exercise, or back surgery is better than physical therapy, or back surgery is better than just no surgery. And the research shows that about a third of people who get that kind of back surgery for pain are better. A third of people are unchanged. A third of people are worse. This is not a great result. And while, as you pointed out, some people do get better with back surgery, it is something that I believe we will have to start moving away from as all of this research and all of this data becomes more and more apparent. Mm. I understand why people want back surgery, because they're desperate. They'll do anything. But the research does not support the level of back surgery we're doing in this country.
Dr. Oldham, what do you think?
I think I agree with that. I think there are some other factors in play, too, which, procedures like this make a lot of money for the system. That's one of the things that comes into play as well. Just to quickly touch base on the callers, I think all of us on this panel today would probably say that this is a very exciting development. You know, we're really excited to see how this may help more patients. And at the same time, we realize that it's not a one-size-fits-all approach, that, you know, that everyone that presents to us is a unique individual. And like the one caller said, you know, she did some reading and she did some journaling and she felt much better. You know, in my practice, I'm not going to say that you will meditate your pain away. But one of the things that I talk to people about is meditation. Maybe it's breath work. Maybe it's acupuncture. What is it that soothes your body? You know, maybe it's talking about it. We're advocating, again, just a different approach of education and participation.
Anything to add there, Dr. Watson?
Well, as a psychologist, I defer to my physician colleagues here, but I do think that we I very much echo Dr. Olden's comment about we take people where they are and want to be sensitive to the needs each unique person has. And for some, it might be back surgery is exacting this need, or like that caller who had such relief from the spinal cord stimulator. These are wonderful results.
Before we lose the hour, I just want to ask Dr. Schubner, we've got about 90 seconds left, for people who've been hearing this, I think, important conversation, but wondering, hey, if this is me or this is my mom or if this is someone I care about who's suffering from chronic pain, some of these ideas are not all that widespread yet. How do you go about maybe pursuing an approach like this if it's not immediately presented as an option? Dr. Schubner?
Yeah, great question. You want to educate yourself. And you want to look, there's two websites that have kind of clearinghouses for all the information that we have on this mind-body approach. And one is the PPDAssociation.org, PPDAssociation.org, and the other is the TMSWiki.org, TMSWiki.org. And you can put those on your website, the radio station. And those are clearinghouses so that people can find all the different books that have been written on this, all the different websites, all the different online programs, and there's a ton of resources out there. You can also find practitioners in your area who do this work on those sites.
The film that we've referenced this hour is called This Might Hurt, and you can find it at thismighthurtfilm.com. Dr. Howard Schubner, Director of Mind-Body Medicine at Providence Hospital in Southfield, Michigan. Thank you for the insight and the work, Doctor. Great to have you on the program today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Aaron Olden, physician and owner of Mindful Medicine Rochester, thanks for the expertise this hour.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. William Watson, associate professor in the Departments of Psychiatry and Neurology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Watson, a pleasure. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
And for anybody suffering, just continue to feel, I hope, no judgment and an open mind all the love and best of luck to you. I know so many people have been down that road, and I know how tough it can be. Megan Mack is the producer and engineer today. And Emma Ray Stein, Evan Dawson, the whole team saying thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.